Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. And later in this episode, the transformative power of horses for the societies which first tamed them.
One of the key aspects of the Horsepower Project is to really understand the role that this particular animal, the horse, played into even making Mongolia and China possible.
And how a deeper understanding of the addictive power of psychoactive drugs may lead in the future to better treatments.
The old mantra of just say no to drugs, well, that's easy to say but hard to do if you're addicted, because your entire brain reward circuitry has been rewired, so to speak, toward taking drugs.
Black holes are the, shall we say, unusual stars of astronomy. Objects so massive no light can escape them, yet astronomers love to look for them. And we're starting today with one that doesn't quite fill the usual headline criteria. It's not a supermassive monster like the one at the centre of our galaxy, weighing millions of solar masses, nor is it dangerously close or particularly young, like you might see in the debris of an exploded star. Let's rewind a bit. Most of the black holes we know about are not seen by their own light, but by the light from material they're devouring from nearby stars, heated as it falls into their grip. Those are the ones astronomers know in our own galaxy and tend to weigh a few to 10 or so solar masses. When the LIGO gravitational wave telescope fired up a decade ago, it quickly saw more massive ones, several tens of solar masses, but they were far, far away in distant galaxies, not in our own. Until now. And this time, it was the precision satellite Gaia that saw, again, not the black hole itself, but the weird dance of a nearby star spiralling around its invisible partner. Astronomer Jerry Gilmore of Cambridge University helped get Gaia launched and is very pleased with this exceptional, unexceptional black hole.
So this one weighs about 35 times the mass of the Sun. So it's quite heavy, actually. The reason that Gaia discovers these things, and this is the third black hole discovered by Gaia, but it's special because its companion is a very low-mass star, a bit like the Sun, but very, very old, and it's, happily for the star, is far enough away from the black hole that it isn't being torn apart by the black hole. And so we have two stars in a wide orbit. It takes about 11 years for the two to orbit each other. In an orbit that's about the size of the solar system, the star that Gaia sees is a bit like the Sun. It's quite a bright star. You can see it in a small telescope. But that star is pulled around on the sky by the mass of the black hole. And that wobble has been detected by Gaia and allows us to weigh the invisible mass, the black hole, which is wobbling the visible mass, which is the star.
And so this is an orbiting system. This is a bit like a planet going around our sun, except in this case, it's a sun, a star, going around the black hole that you can't see. But that's enough information to weigh the black hole.
That's exactly right. I mean, you can pretty well do this with Newton's laws, actually. It's exactly like having planet Jupiter going around the sun, except instead of something that's 100th Jupiter, 100th the mass of the sun, we've got something that's 35 times the mass of the sun, so it's 1,000 times bigger effect.
The point is that Gaia is this incredibly precise telescope, so it's able to see these motions, even though presumably this is quite a distance away and so on, and the motion is not so huge, but it's enough for Gaia to spot.
Oh, yes. Gaia is a deliciously precise thing. It's just beautiful what it does, actually. But you're right. Space is big. Things are far away. And so the actual motion of this thing on the sky is wobbling by small fractions of an arc second. So that's equivalent to thickness of a fingernail across a country. These are the sorts of numbers we're measuring. But for Gaia, those are big numbers.
All right. So the important thing, if I've understood you right, the important thing is that this is much larger than the kinds of black holes we've conventionally seen in our own galaxy. It's sort of comparable to the ones that these gravitational waves have discovered in remote galaxies. So it's sort of making more sense about what kind of black holes exist in the universe overall.
Yeah, it answers two questions, actually. First is, are these things that we are seeing across the universe in gravitational waves actually normal astrophysical events, such as they're rare, so we haven't seen one in our solar neighbourhood yet, but they're not unique. Eventually, we will see one in our solar neighbourhood. The second thing that it's able to start answering is, where on earth do these things come from? Why are these gravitational wave black holes 5 or 10 times more massive than the sort of stellar mass black holes that are being created today just through normal stellar evolution?
I mean, I thought that black holes were just formed when you had a supernova, the stuff in the middle got crushed, and hey, bingo, so a bigger star would give you a bigger black hole.
It can be like that. That's the way that a normal star a few times, maybe 7 or 8 or 10 times the mass of our sun, will end by a big supernova, and at the heart of that supernova will be maybe 4 or 5 solar mass black hole left over. But even a star that's formed today of 100 times the mass of the sun will, during its lifetime, lose 95 of those 100 solar masses and will still end up like a 5 solar mass black hole. So stars of the type that are common in our Milky Way today cannot form 35 solar mass black holes.
So how does this new black hole help explain that?
Well, it's its friend, actually. It's its companion that tells us there, because the companion retains the memory of the chemical elements that it was made from. It tells us the age of the system. This thing's maybe 11.5 or 12 billion years old.
So you're telling me what, these were born together? The black hole and the little star were born together?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, binary stars tend to be twins, both formed at the same time. They can have different masses.
And they've just been dancing together for, you're saying, 11 or 12 billion years like this?
That's right. They've been
pirouetting through space. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, given that the period of this thing's 11 years, as you can tell, they've been around a billion times, so they've got to know each other.
You say that these were very early formed stars. We were talking about some stars that are almost pure hydrogen and helium only a few weeks ago, discovered by the James Webb telescopes. So are you saying that this black hole was once one of these first stars and it's just sort of died and collapsed under its own weight, something like that?
Yeah, that's the most likely. And because this is new, people will be warming up their computers as we speak, building new models of it. But the straightforward explanation is that this thing started off as a pair of stars, one quite low mass, maybe about 1 or 2 solar masses, and it's the survivor of that still there. And this heavy thing, maybe 50 solar masses, quite rapidly turned into this 35 solar mass black hole. And the key is that the evolution of a star and the amount of mass it ends up with depends critically on its chemistry. And that's because as a star ages, the heat coming out from the centre, what we see as light, pushes against the atmosphere of the star. And if the atmosphere is fairly opaque, the heat builds up until eventually the radiation just blows away the atmosphere of the star. And so the star loses most of its mass. And in fact, it can lose 90% of its mass. But for these very early stars, they've got almost no chemical elements in their atmospheres, so they're transparent. And so the radiation can stream out, and the star keeps its mass. And so when it gets to the end of its life, it's still very close to the mass it had on day one. And so that collapses down and gives you a high mass black hole.
I can see now why you say that this is such an important discovery, because, yes, as you say, it confirms we have these pretty massive black holes in our own galaxy, and it's telling you something pretty crucial about how they originated. How difficult was it to find? I mean, is this going to be a one-off in our galaxy, or as you keep looking with Gaia, you're going to see a lot more?
Oh, there are going to be a lot more. Yeah, the thing about Gaia is the Gaia data that's been released so far is only from the first 3 years of the mission. This new data set that this comes from is based on the first 5 years of Gaia. And this is just a sanity check on that data. It's not a proper analysis. So we are absolutely confident that even when this five-year data set comes out, when it's all tidied up, there will be hundreds of discoveries, not perhaps as extreme as this one, but as astrophysically interesting as this one. And then when the full data set comes out, it will be a total slam dunk.
Astronomer Jerry Gilmore on a black hole that unexpectedly pulls together all kinds of astrophysical threads that we've been talking about here on Science in Action in recent years. Addiction, I've probably been repeating over my career in science journalism, is a hijacking of the biochemical circuitry we evolved in the deep past to improve our chances of survival. We need the biological incentives to do something as simple as, say, drinking a glass of water. But those evolved incentives can be hacked by, for example, psychoactive drugs, cocaine and so on. It's been a sort of useful hand-waving explanation. But a study in Science this week, bringing together teams of molecular biologists, neuroscientists, brain imagers, and psychiatrist Eric Nessler, have dug way further into the where in the brain and the how of the chemistry that drives addiction. In mice, at least. On a line from New York, Eric confirmed that the hijacking analogy still does apply.
The reward circuitry in a mammalian brain evolved a long time ago to involve the use of dopamine to indicate to an individual when something good, useful, new has happened, and continually shaping our behavior. So if you think of the way we go through life with food, social interaction, drink, sex, and so on, we are continually surveilling our environment, assessing how things have been, and it helps us make motivated decisions through the course of a day, a multitude of decisions every day. What drugs of abuse do is that they activate the same reward circuitry that is activated by these natural rewards, just with a stronger magnitude effect and with a more lasting effect. And most importantly, unrelated to any purposeful behavior. So when we eat, food is good because it maintains our nutrition. Drugs of abuse don't have that adaptive role. We've been using the words drugs of abuse hijack the reward circuitry, drugs of abuse corrupt the reward circuitry for decades, knowing behaviorally they do. We see that in humans for sure, and we see it in animals as well. But the neural basis of it has really remained elusive. And so this study, I think, provides new insight into how drugs of abuse have that effect on the reward circuitry.
This is all being done in mice for obvious reasons, but you're looking at the whole brain physiology, but you're also looking at the individual neurons that are activated. You're looking at the chemistry by which it's done. You're looking at the genetics by which it's done. So this is a pretty thorough look you're taking. Give us a sense of how you go about this. And I notice that you're sort of looking at something as simple as how much the mice drink and eat, whether or not they're having some drugs. That's the simple part for me.
So we published a paper about a year and a half ago, the same group, which basically took mice. We fasted them overnight, so they're a little hungry or a little thirsty. We deprived them of food or water, not both. And when you give a hungry animal access to food, they eat it avidly. And we recorded from the brains of those animals, as you say, individual cells from the nucleus accumbens, this core region of the brain's reward circuitry, and isolating the two major subtypes of nerve cells in that brain region. We call them D1 neurons or D2 neurons. What we found a couple of years ago is that feeding in a hungry animal and drinking water in a thirsty animal lead to the activation of most of the same nerve cells in nucleus accumbens. The conclusion of that study was that the nucleus accumbens, this reward circuit, is not giving us specific information about being hungry or thirsty. It's just a basic need state. It's a state of reward consumption. So in this new study, we wanted to use that as a foundation to understand how drugs of abuse are affecting those responses. And so the first thing we found is that in response to two drugs of abuse, cocaine and morphine, which are very different drugs, but each can induce a very similar behavioral syndrome that we label as addiction, that most of the same cells are again activated by these rewards. And so again, there's nothing specific in the nucleus accumbens that is signaling food, water, cocaine, morphine. It's more of a general state of motivated responses. What we found, in fact, is that cocaine and morphine, just like I said glibly without much data 35 years ago, that drugs of abuse activate the reward circuitry with a greater magnitude and persistence. That's precisely what we showed of the ability of cocaine and morphine to affect these thirsty, hungry neurons in nucleus accumbens. The effect of drug is stronger and longer lasting than the natural reward.
Does that then open up, and I presume this is why you're doing it, new ideas for how addiction can be treated? Are there sort of interventions you can imagine that might help someone who's addicted by using this knowledge to get them off the addiction?
Yes, precisely. The challenge in addiction treatment for years has been, how do you undo, counter this corrupting influence of drugs of abuse on a reward circuitry that is critical for survival and health, well-being, without affecting the natural functioning of that circuitry? So we could block reward in a human with various types of available drugs, and we can diminish a person's interest in a drug of abuse. The problem is that by doing that, we're also damaging the individual's interest in natural rewards, things that make the person function, survive, and be happy: food, sex, social interaction, and so on. The challenge in the field for years has been, how do you break the influence of drugs without impairing this natural reward functioning? What I've talked about thus far is the effect of a single dose of morphine or cocaine. But addiction requires repeated drug exposure. And in this case, we just use 5 daily doses. So it's an early study. It would be important to look at even longer term drug administration. But even over 5 daily doses of cocaine and morphine, what we found is that the drugs gradually and progressively disrupt an animal's response for natural rewards. So this very basic function of a thirsty animal drinking water and a hungry animal eating food, both were disrupted by these repeated doses of cocaine or repeated doses of morphine. And what was interesting to us is that the two drugs did so in a very different pattern of effects on cells. Cocaine's effects were primarily driven by this D1 type neuron I mentioned earlier, whereas the effects of morphine after repeated dosing were mediated by equal effects on both D1 and D2 type neurons. We then used advanced tools of molecular biology, single nucleus RNA sequencing, to identify how it is that the drugs are having this effect. And we came up with a particular gene called REB, R-H-E-B, which we think is particularly involved in this disrupting effect of cocaine and morphine on the processing of natural rewards. Now, with this, it becomes feasible, perhaps, to say, okay, I can now block particularly these disrupting effects of drugs on natural reward processing without affecting natural rewards themselves, perhaps even restoring normal functioning in individuals chronically exposed to the drug. And that's what we were able to show at the very end of this paper, that by manipulating this one gene, REB, in nucleus accumbens, we were able to block the ability of repeated drug exposure to produce this corrupting influence on a hungry animal feeding and a thirsty animal drinking water.
So in a sense, it sounds like you've got a target where you can interrupt some of these addiction processes and get people back to normal behavior, I guess, with sort of maybe behavioral therapies and so on. But it just gives you another way to help to rehabilitate patients, possibly.
Exactly. That's precisely right. This is in a mouse. And so the next major step is to see whether it is possible to demonstrate similar mechanisms in people and to make new medications targeting REB or downstream parts of the same pathway, and test our hypothesis that by disrupting this one signaling pathway, we might be able to help diminish these damaging effects of drugs of abuse. And this is exactly what we think is needed clinically. I am a psychiatrist. I've treated patients with substance use disorders. And one of the major challenges is that the addiction itself makes it extremely difficult for people to utilize tools that are made available to them to start rehabilitating their lives. You know, the old mantra in the United States, at least, of just say no to drugs. Well, that's easy to say, but hard to do if you're addicted, because your entire brain reward circuitry has been rewired, so to speak, toward taking drug, as we show in this paper, in fact. What has long been felt the need is clinically is a medication to help people overcome that powerful biological influence so that they can start rebuilding their lives. And we think this is a very important lead toward that end.
Eric Nessler of the Friedman Brain Institute at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, summing up what he told me were 5 years of experiments spanning just about every modern technique in biology. 10 years ago, he said, none of this would have been possible. The sea change in gene sequencing has also allowed a transformation in archaeology. We're quite often talking about insights into our deep ancestors, which we've learned from scraps of DNA in their bones or teeth, and into the diseases which they suffered. A project called Horsepower has brought together teams across Europe, as well as in Mongolia and China, to look at the prehistoric relations between horses and humans. And there's a play on words in the project title. It's not just about the muscle power of horses, which we could use once they became domesticated, but the political power they bestowed on the societies that got there first. And when I visited project leader Ludovic Orlando in his genetics labs in Toulouse, the first thing I learned was how many horse skeletons have survived over the millennia.
Here you have in this room about 8,000 horse bones or teeth that are stored.
And these are horse bones from where?
So from all around the planet, actually. And they date as far back as a few hundreds of thousands of years.
A few hundreds
yes,
of thousands?
Yes, absolutely. Down right. to probably the 19th century here.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's the Chinese-Mongolian ones I've come to talk to you about.
Right. So here, probably in that very bag, actually, you have a sample of horse, which is a number of teeth, as you see, premolar and molar teeth. And these ones, UUJ40, they come from a site from Mongolia called Uxing Uvur. And that's a site that is about 3,000 years old, when at that time people were actually sacrificing their horses for big ceremonies to celebrate the death of one of their elite members.
Well, okay, so this brings, I think, the whole story to frame. So first of all, horses are phenomenally important at this point. They're domesticated already.
Yeah.
These are part of what's driving their society.
Most people will think that horses are a fantastic vehicle, because they are. You can travel fast with the horse, more than what you could have done on your own legs, isn't it? But horses, you make war with them as well. You kill other people, or you dominate other people. In the past, people were using the horse for whatever that animal can give us, including the symbolic aspects of our relation to the horse, the religious aspects.
Do you see, for example, the horse equivalent of the Rolls Royce for the leader of the gang, or the Ferrari for the one who's going to race off? You're seeing all that variety, are you?
Absolutely. They are the big ones, the fast ones. So in the past, we see that there is inequality building on whoever gets access to some types of horses, mostly on the number of horses they have access to. And we see that in the archaeological record, for example, in the size of the funerary burials that people were building. And so we have examples in Mongolia or also in other parts of the world where people were rich enough to afford the sacrifice of hundreds, if not thousands of horses to celebrate their death so that those animals could actually accompany them in the afterlife world, basically.
I love it because you call it horsepower, which sort of sounds like a unit of energy, I suppose. But this is actually about the power that the horses lent to their owners. It's the political power is in fact what you're talking about.
Absolutely. You know, we tend to think about the past, our global past, we humans, as just a matter of humans controlling humans or trading with humans. But in fact, the more we do archaeology or history, actually, the more we discover that animal, plants, microbes have actually shaped history as we know it. And so one of the key aspects of the Horsepower Project is to really understand the role that this particular animal, the horse, played into even making Mongolia and China possible in terms of geopolitical power. So if you think about that part of the world at that time, I'm talking about probably anywhere between 3,000 years ago to 2,000 years ago, you have empires rising in this part of the world. Some are nomad, steppe nomad people. So they are using the horse as a vehicle and they live on horses literally, right? So without the horse, they wouldn't even come to be. Isn't it? But what is interesting in this project is what type of horses did they even engineer to make themselves emerge as a political power? So you see that once you have the horse in the picture, you have a way to unfold history in a totally unexpected manner.
I mean, it sounds like it's a mirror of what happened when steam power or the internal combustion engine came in. It just transforms society, transforms the relationships between communities. You're saying that you think that the horses had that kind of transformational role?
I take always a picture, a sort of image, when I try to explain what I'm doing. And the image that I came to choose is actually the iPhone or the mobile phone. The minute we had the mobile phone, right, probably in a decade or in two decades, we all have one. And you have to think that somewhere around 4,000 years ago, when the first people started to interact with the horse, control the reproduction of this animal, this has become such a fashionable commodity that all of a sudden, whoever was domesticating the horse, which was a very tiny part of the world, by the way, north of the Caucasian Range, 4,000 years ago, all of a sudden, and by that I mean a century or two, the horse became global. You could find that type of horse, that bloodline that my group has sequenced. You could find it from the shores of the Pacific as far east to as far west as the shores of the Atlantic. So that means that once humanity came across with the horse and realized the power that that animal could give, then all of a sudden, all of the societies wanted to have access to the horse. So that is a commodity such as the mobile phone today. It was vital, crucial to the development of geopolitics at that time. By and large, what is really important to keep in mind is that even though the horse was the instrument of kings and emperors, that's true, it was also the instrument of anyone, of the random people. And probably it's more important for understanding the true diversity of past societies, isn't it? So we have thousands of anonymous horses in those boxes, those from the peasants, those from monks, those from, we don't even know from whom, actually, but they tell us globally, collectively, a great deal about the diversity of practices that people developed in the past to interact and master, I guess, such an important animal.
Presumably, as you go through hundreds of years, the generations of these horses, presumably you can see, as it were, the Mark One, the Mark Two, how they improved, when they were going for speed, the ones which were going for strength.
What you just said is the last 10 years of my life, actually, right? This is exactly why we have started such projects in the first place, right? Can we travel back in time and look at the horse for the whole diversity at whichever period you're interested in? And so if you can read the past in different steps, say, go back to Roman time, for example, now you picture what was a horse by the time of the Romans? And by that you learn, well, what was very important? Is it speed that is important? Is it strength?
And so by looking at these genomes, looking at the archaeology, looking at these genomes, presumably from time to time you can look at the people as well who are buried there?
Yeah, so it will not be done as the core of this project to look at the DNA from people, because there are other groups doing that around the world.
But it's bringing all that information together that lets biological information tell us about our human history.
Absolutely. So it's the collection of all the kinds of proxies that we could get access to that will tell, I hope, a compelling story, an untold story about those people and their relationships with the animals. It's not just biological, by the way, because in our team, we have some scholars at the British Museum who are going to study the metals in the horse equipment, in the horse gears, in whatever equipment that people were using to ride the horse, for example, all the bronzes that they were using to actually make chariots. So the same way we could track horses and their origins through genes, we can track the origins of the equipment through the metals that people were using to even make up this equipment. And so now we could start overlaying those maps to see if horses came from the same regions as the ores that they were the people were using to create the equipment or not. And if not, or if yes, then this is all of a sudden the trading patterns that those societies developed a few thousand years ago that we would have access to.
We have talked on the program in the past about domestication of, well, plants, but also of animals, so pigs, chickens from jungle fowl and so on. And that seemed to happen a lot earlier, I think. Is there something in your research which is saying that domesticating horses was harder?
The horse is probably the last of the big herbivores to have been domesticated. It was domesticated 4,000 years ago, which is 6,000 years after the cattle, for example. So something that was so instrumental for human history in terms of movements of populations, in terms of war making, in terms of farming as well, because horses can help us farm. Well, this is a very late invention in our history. And why so? Why? Because people had the knowledge about how could we even control the reproduction of the animals. Why did it come as a last idea to do that on the horse? Perhaps even more surprising is to hear that we domesticated the donkey successfully 7,000 years ago. So we were doing that on the sister species 3,000 years earlier. It makes no sense. So why is it that we waited for so long before taming that beast and use it for making nothing less but human history is a mystery to me.
Ludovic Orlando from the impressively named Centre for Anthropobiology and Genetics at the University Paul Sabatier in Toulouse. And I'm looking forward to what they learn. I'm Ronan Pease. The producer is Jonathan Blackwell. And we're powering off to the European Space Agency next week to hear about multiple plans to touch down on a tiny asteroid swinging by planet Earth in 5 years.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.